it's recording. So I'll put this up tonight. Very easy. I found actually in teaching that audio is the most efficient way, along with the slides. You don't need video. Oh, sorry. There was water there. I'm going to need. No, I brought it along here. Audio is very, very efficient to go along with slides. So again, just one. Yeah, thanks. So thank you, Eric and Robert, for nominating me and for the committee, as I said. Today I thought the easiest way, it's a lot of life and bio to look back over, but I thought I would, where are we here? Did I finish this? Oh, yeah, I did, I guess. I have two meanings of bio, my own life in bio, but also biologic. It means that there should be some biologic in what we do in biostatistics. Can't all be driven by machines. And so today I thought I would talk about some of the excitement and satisfaction, and there's been a lot of it over those years, but also some of the embarrassments. Although most of the embarrassments I've told to the students already in the session on Saturday, and I've also written that out, because as I said to the students, they only gave me 4 minutes to give this after-dinner talk in Ireland 10 years ago. 4 minutes for me to talk isn't enough. But they were in a hurry to the bar after the dinner. So I came back and I wrote it all out and I put it on the web. My own web, because none of the journals will put it, but this is what I called it. So basically it was a lot of stories I'm willing to tell now about things that went wrong. And 98% of them were poor communication over technical matters and so on. It was a failure to communicate. So I think today I will just pick a few things from the early part of my ROC career and a little bit also about consultations just because they were interesting. I don't do a lot of them. I didn't do much consulting. I never was rich from that. But anyway, the first thing I think I talked to the students about on Saturday was the mentorship and great examples I had from people like Fred Mosteller, who I just saw for 3 years, but really had a big influence on me and the rest of my time. And this other good friend, Steve, I knew for 7 years in Buffalo and Boston. And then other extra good mentors I had as well. I'll be coming back to Steve again in a little while. Yeah, I've had great mentors all along. And I'd say one of them, a Harvard person, Barbara McNeil, she was a radiologist, or nuclear medicine actually, as well as being a PhD in biochemistry. And she was a big influence, and just by good luck, started me on an area that nobody had been in the statistical world. The psychophysics people had been in it, but nobody statistical. So I was the first one in, and then I left it, and it's done its own thing ever since. And the reason, it got started in a very innocent way. Very, very innocently, we were looking at the use of CT scans of the head in Boston in 1978, because CT scanners were new then, and they were rationed, and people were trying to use them efficiently and not use them if they knew the test would come out negative. So we were trying to predict who would have a negative CT scan and didn't need the scan. So she collected the first 2,000 requisitions for CT scans of the head in Boston in her hospital. And then we're trying to figure out what was going on. And we wrote several papers on that. But the important one, innocently, quite separately, she said, I have a great chance here to study radiologists and what information matters to them. Because she wanted to know how accurate are radiologists when they read images in conjunction with the patient history, rather than without it. Because she said, just like statisticians, we're complaining all the time that we're being treated like technicians, and we're asked to analyze images and data without being given the full picture. The radiologists were really frustrated by that and thought that if they had the patient history as well, it would help in their search of the x-ray. And so Barbara got 4 radiology residents at Harvard to read 109 CT images of the head. 50 were in patients that she knew independently by later proof had some lesions. And 58 went a year without any problems, and she considered them to have had no problem and no lesion. So they read each image twice, once with and once without, about 3 or 4 weeks apart in random order, so they wouldn't know what was happening. And This is the distribution of the 109 ratings from one resident in one setting, either on member if it's with or without. Right? But you see, the truth is here on the rows. I would have called that today disease present, disease absent, or lesion or not. And this is the probabilistic reading method they used a lot in the radar and signal detection business in the 60s and 70s, the rating method. So that's what you have. And now the question is, you're going to compare that index of accuracy from that with the one when they were or were not reading. And then you have four paired evaluations with the four evaluators. So Barbara's research system was having trouble fitting, using the Fortran program to fit this particular model. This is a model they used a lot in signal detection theory, and it basically is two overlapping Gaussian distributions, and the distance between them is a measure of discrimination. And she was having trouble with it on this one. It was a long Fortran program. And this is what she was trying to fit, basically, these two overlapping distributions being fitted to a 2x5 table of frequencies. Right? And, this is going to fall off here. So that's the binormal model for ROC. Just a second here. I don't know why this thing is strange. Okay, this is the part that's unusual. Okay, so the thing is, let's look at the raw data first. The raw data are these four circles here. And you get those by making four 2x2 tables, each time changing your criterion for positivity. Right? It's like changing your alpha in a statistical test, and that changed the other one the same way. So empirically we have these four, but then how do you fit this model to it, and that's what's going on. It's a very intense model in the sense that in addition to the two parameters measuring the distance between these and whether they're equal variance or not, you have to actually estimate the four cutoff points at which the readers are reading or operating. Right? So the four cutoff points become parameters, which I find very strange, but that's the way it has to be done. So you have a six-parameter model for 8 degrees of freedom. So it's a pretty tight model. Anyhow, that's what it was about. So she asked me to get it to work. I hadn't a clue about ROC analysis, signal detection theory, any of this. My very first encounter, and so my usual is, show me the manual and I'll try and read it and I'll get back to you tomorrow. And the manual was an inch thick, I remember, photocopied, no email in those days. And I took it home with me. She also gave me a 1978 nuclear medicine article and one from Science about signal detection in 1973. Brought it home with me and started reading it on the night of August 27, 1980. Why do I know that? It was 4 days before I was to start working at McGill. I was leaving the Farber Center and coming to McGill, and they were waiting for me to teach my course at McGill. That night, my wife went into labor, and I still remember it was the middle of the manual when her water broke. I took her to Framingham Union to have our second son, and he delayed us 10 days getting to Boston, and then I started 607, 10 days late here at McGill, with 7 students in 1980, graduate students in EPI. But the course quickly grew in popularity, and one of the things I started doing was recording, when I taught probability, whether I had a duplicate birthday in the class or not. And I had collected 13 years worth of data on that. So I asked this, I just handed around the sheet and I said, "You, this year we're using an X, or this year we're using that," and I could count up at the end of the class, or they'd shout bingo when there was a duplicate birthday. So you'll see here in 1981, we had 27 students. I got a duplicate. Yes, the next year. Yes, the next year. The next year, I had 20. No duplicate. The next one, 21, etc. So I have these data now. You were gone. Not come yet. I think I stopped this around here. So it turns out now that the time until you get a duplicate is a random variable that you could measure its full distribution by. But you have 9 data points or 13 data points here. They're actually all interval censored because it happened. I didn't record when it happened. So all I know is it either happened by that time or it didn't. That's current status or interval censoring data. So those kind of data are all over the place, and they don't need a course in survival analysis. This is not survival analysis. but it's the same kind of data. Anyhow, so my other point is, if you can't convince people about the birthday problem by algebra, maybe you can by data. Right? So that fall, I wasn't in much demand yet for collaborating and so on. There was no internet, whatever people didn't know about. So I tend to think a lot about the ROC stuff. And I could see from this area under the curve that they were, I kept trying to think of it and said, this sounds familiar to me. I should be able to figure this out. And then it dawned on me that what they were measuring with the area under the curve was the probability that y was greater than x. If you have two distributions, a random y greater than a random x. And it's used in the null for a Wilcoxon test. And I knew, of course, that the null variance for the Wilcoxon test involves a root of 12 for the variance of a uniform. That's fine. But then I'm saying, I don't want this as a null test. The question is, I want a big area, and what standard error will it have? Right? And the non-null standard error was not easy. We don't think about that. We teach it because it's an easy one to teach for the null standard error, for a test. But I was using the area under the curve now as a, or Wilcoxon statistic, as a measure of accuracy or discrimination or whatever. So I needed to do empirical work and the mainframe to start calculating standard errors away from the null. And I had no money, and you had to pay for money at McGill, for computing at McGill. And I hadn't applied to NCERC until 1983, but I got cute, and each student in the first and second term got an allowance on the mainframe, a free allowance for courses. You guys, some of you remember that. So I asked for more students than there were and took all the extra money to calculate the standard errors and so on, and I started figuring out what was going on. And I figured out that the standard error based on two overlapping negative exponential distributions would give you a very tight fit for the standard error and a very nice bound. I didn't really understand it, but anyway, we said we'll write this up for the Journal of Mathematical Psychology. So I went off to the library to get the instructions for authors. That's where they were found in the end of the December version each year, like all the old guys know what I'm talking about, right? And to read the instructions, and came away devastated because I happened to thumb through the journal, and what do I find but this article. This thing just won't stay on me here. This article had already done everything and had all the insights that I had just figured out on my own at McGill with no internet, no anything. So it was really quite devastating. There wasn't one practical thing in it. It was all theoretical bounds and worst case scenarios, so not one practical result, but it had all the theoretical things. So we went back to the drawing board, and Barbara was very good. She said to me, look, there's a big unmet need in radiology. You don't worry about these theoretical types. Why not write up something practical for radiology? And we did. They had never heard of a theta hat in radiology before, and standard errors and that sort of thing. And so typesetting it for the journal was a real pain, but I insisted on thetas and theta hats and that sort of thing. We set out all the connections we'd made, and then we got to the practical stuff. Particularly exploiting the non-null Wilcoxon through the negative exponentials. And of course, the key in that paper, the success of it, we actually showed an example of the raw data and then showed people how to work through it. And we showed them the detailed steps for getting not just a standard error, but how to calculate without having to rank everything yourself. If you do it in a clever way here, you can work out all the summary statistics just from summing rows and columns and things like that. We did that. So we had an area of 89.3 here and a standard error of 3.2. But the thing I think that helped the most was that right around this time, this is 1982, there was a killer app on the market. Who was around in 1982 or 81 for the killer app?
Lotus 1-2-3.
Before Lotus 1-2-3, yeah. VisiCalc was around. And people were buying a $2,000 Apple II machine so that they could run this $100 software on this $2,000 Apple machine. Apple II, well before Mac. Yeah, so that was a stroke of luck that this guy, who was a family physician and interested in sore throats and whether you could tell a strep throat from a non-strep throat with scoring systems. He was the one that got very interested in automating this, and of course the VisiCalc spreadsheet idea was perfect for implementing my calculations. I thought I'd already left it perfectly good for a pencil and paper and a calculator. There was only a square root needed, but he thought he could get it all done in an hour, in a 1 minute. That was a big breakthrough. So he was a big champion of it. But these are some of the other things that we were able to see here. And we did the power calculations and a whole lot more. And then the second paper was the one we really wanted to get at, but we had to solve other problems first, because with paired data now it gets much more nasty. But there was a big advantage in radiology, because you nearly always can do the two images on the same patient and take advantage of the pairing to get smaller standard errors. So that was a big thing that I think we were the first to talk about that. Bamberg didn't talk about that at all. So that was our second paper. And then it actually gets more complicated than that, because you have random effects now for the four readers. And so on. Our correlation coefficients were very, very clunky. And the whole thing was kind of clunky. And I tell people now, don't use it anymore. Use either this method, the method in Biometrica by Mitchell Gale and them, or use this method from DeLong and DeLong, which used U-statistics and matrices, but a SAS macro at the time, to do all the calculations. The only thing is, as far as I'm concerned, this was still in matrix form, and you couldn't explain it to radiologists. And so the paper I'm most proud of in the ROC business is this one, which gave a nice, simple structure to the U-statistics. And you can do it all by saying you want to compare a sample of X's with a sample of Y's. So these are your U-statistics right there. And you can get all the variance calculations and everything right from them. So I also am proud of the fact that Margaret Pepe, another Irish person, took the idea we had in that paper of placement values, which are what the U-statistics are, how one observation is placed in the other distribution, and ran with it in her book and so on. But Margaret, she's from the University of Washington, they're very elitist in biostat, and said, my putting those papers in radiology and medical decision-making, they were not real biostatistics, and that we should have put them in biometrics and statistics of management where they'd be read by real biostatisticians. Now, I have no counterfactual. You know, you either do one way or do the other. But I'm going to give you something now, and you can see what you think. 1994, somebody, two authors, one of whom sadly just died on Sunday, Doug Altman, did this very interesting paper about how fast statistical methods get into the biomedical literature. And it's quite fun. And they looked at these particular papers. I don't know why they picked these, but this is the one, these are the ones they picked. Cochrane, Wolf's method, Kaplan-Meier, Mantel, Hensel, Cohen, Mantel, Box, Cox, Mantel, etc. Pedro, Cox, Dempster, you know, EM algorithm, Hanley, McNeil. So, anyhow. And then they sorted them out by decade as to when things happened. And so this is the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, right? And you see there, we're well ahead of the pack by putting our stuff into the other literature. There's one scale, some of these are missing. Who's missing from this? Cox's paper and one other. They needed a different scale. Right? Cox and Peter's papers needed another scale altogether. But his point is, things are slow getting into it. And so here we are again now with the speed at which things are happening. That's when their survey left off. And then, and skip ahead too, I want you to know which of those four now in this one, in the bottom here, which of those four is the leader today? Okay? Yeah. Huh? Ryman.
Oh.
Yeah. I think his was a book, and the next two were published outside the statistical literature, right? And the last one, of course, was published in Biometrica, I think, so whatever. So anyway, the message is, maybe you should be going to where the customers are, rather than having it filtered through the biostat literature. I'm not sure. The other thing, of course, that's very accepted today is the idea of doing a package, right? So VisiCalc then was like the package, but now people have wisened up to the fact you need a package to get your stuff out. People need to be able on Saturday night, able to be at their own kitchen table, find the stuff, finish it, be able to do the calculation, not have to wait till Monday to talk to a statistician. Right? They have this crazy weight on this thing and it keeps falling off. Sorry. Okay, maybe I'll just hold on to it. Yeah. So, the other thing I say is that nowadays, you know, we went back to, here are the two books that have come out since. And George Stein said to me, Jim, once the books comes out, your citations are going to drop off. But they haven't. But one thing I'll say about citations today is that this is the way they are. People are typing in citations today without even looking at the authors. They don't know if they're male or female, how to spell their name. They've cut and pasted them. There's no sense of scholarship, I think. And it's quite sad that you thousands of citations, they don't even have the paper in their computer, not a mind have read it. So, and that reminds me of this quote from this very wise Scotsman. They do it more for support than illumination, more to impress than to really say something. Now, I want to come to the three extramural ones, and I'll do them in that order that they're there. Yeah. Starting with the Ken West one. And this started because of this particular article here, which is a PhD thesis from the University of British Columbia. Direct-to-consumer advertising, I have to explain to you what it is. Turn on American TV and you'll see the ads for drugs. They're going straight to the consumer. The Americans and the New Zealanders are the only ones that allow that kind of advertising. Every other country except the US and New Zealand says you can either mention the drug or the condition, but not both in the same ad. Right? Only US and New Zealand. But Ken West was getting upset that the cable companies were stealing advertising from Ken West and the media, and they wanted to invoke the Canadian Constitution and Bill of Rights or whatever, Charter of Freedoms, to say we should be allowed to tell Canadian people, consumers, about the drug and the condition as together. And they were challenging. And this particular article, which says that the more you go to a doctor, sorry, the more you watch ads on TV, the more you're likely when you go to a doctor to ask for drugs that you may not need, and the more pressured the doctor is going to feel that they have to give it to you. So this showed that quite clearly, comparing Vancouver and Sacramento. And also within, the more people in Vancouver saw ads, the more they asked, the more they asked, the more they got, and the more the doctor was actually quite ambivalent about whether they should have. So this was really bothering the Ken West people because it was hurting their case against whatever. So I got a call from the lawyer who had the case on behalf of Ken West and asked me if I knew this article. And I said, yes, by strange coincidence, Abby Lipman and I have used this as a lovely teaching example in our seminar course. And he explained about the case and so on. And he wondered what I thought about the soundness of the article and would I help evaluate it. He meant trash it. And I said, no, I like the study and I like the Canadian laws the way they were. And I also said I'd had a very nasty encounter with a consultation for a small company that was developing a diagnostic test for Alzheimer's. I advise be very careful of them. They're not your friends. And I signed a non-disclosure agreement with them with 5 years. That was a disaster as well. Anyway, he said to me, I know we're the skunk in the corner, but can you suggest any good Canadian statisticians who might evaluate it for us? So I had to think who are the good Canadian statisticians first, and I had a list in my head, and I said, okay. So I gave them the names, and I said, I don't know what their politics are, or whether they take money or they do stuff or not, or whether they're likely to help, but here they are for what they're worth. And a year later, the Government of Canada lawyer now on the other side, who's defending the status quo, called me to say that a statistician, who happened to be with the number one in my list, had written an affidavit that was very critical of the article and really trashed it, and asked if I would advise the government if that was going too far. Could I at least look at it and see? So I was quite surprised at the over-the-top. This was, by the way, the affidavit written by that person in Ontario, very critical of the thing. You'll find it online. I won't name the person here, although that person has had an award just like me and Carl. So that'll narrow it a little bit for you. So I was surprised at the thing, and then we wrote a counter affidavit. These are depositions, written deposition, and we were limited to just, is the article good? Is the criticism right or not? So here's mine. Is that right? Yeah, mine. Can West file for bankruptcy before it got to the court case? But we were cross-examined, each one of us, by a lawyer just in a room with the tape recorder on, and they transcribed it. So I have transcripts of the cross-examination as well, and they were quite something. In the cross-examination, the lawyer asked me, do you know Doug Altman? I said, yeah, I like Doug, a good book, and so on. I haven't read it very carefully, but I know him, he's very well respected. Well then, wouldn't you agree with me that? And then he says, I'm going to pick a sentence from Doug's book, that for valid inference, you need a representative sample. And I said, no, you don't. He said, what do you mean, you're disagreeing with Doug Altman, the book? I said, you're probably cherry-picking, but let me give you an example. So I started bugging him, and I said, if I told you that aspirin cuts the risk of heart attack by half, would you take it? I said, okay, the study was done in a very unrepresentative sample. It was done in American doctors. And I said, not only that, American male doctors. Should your wife take this? Should car mechanics say this? And then I was heading down the list, and I said, I was going to say, should rats take this? Because lawyers to me are below the rats. Right? But I stopped myself at that point. Stay professional, Handy. Don't look too... Right? But that's what I wanted to say to him. Anyway, it was quite a tug of war, and I can tell you more about it privately. But the one thing, one of the... and I had to give up the case. It got to me, I don't know what else. I had some health events, including a stent, that September. I don't know how much this played into it. It got very dirty. Michael Escobar is here, and he'll tell you, he took over on my side. And we were pro bono for the government side. The other person, I don't know if he got his check or not from Can West before they went bankrupt. But one of the points here is that one of the complaints was that there were only 10 events that we didn't follow this rule. Right? You need at least 10 outcome events. This was a logistic regression. And they had 74 events, and they'd put 12 parameters in. And of course, he counted every single dummy variable and everything as a parameter. So does that alarm you? So when the lawyer asked me, I said, well, if that's the case, a whole lot of my colleagues should be in jail for malpractice. Including Sammy Suisa. I saw Sammy fit a logistic regression with 17 events, and I think he had about 12 variables in there. I don't know how he got away with it, but anyway, you see the issue. Yeah, it is a tricky one, right? And then this is the second thing. You know, this is the one that really says, look, it's going to mess up, you can switch direction, it can give imprecision, it can do all sorts of things, even the direction. And so I'm curious what you think. How would you answer that? See, it's very easy to be on the side that says things are wrong. It's a lot harder to stay on the side. This man also didn't want anything except randomized trial evidence. I said, well, we'd be in a bad way if the world could only depend on randomized evidence for everything. But anyhow, this was one of the articles he was referring to, although he never actually said it. But when I looked at it, he was using a lot of this, and... I found a much better one, much more directed one, right the week before I had to testify. And this is actually way better. It makes way more sense. This one. Why? Because one of the things I still teach our students, and even more so now, is as I'm concerned, there's a big distinction here that even with the same equation, right? The logistic or whatever kind of equation you have, how many meanings or what interest could you have in the output from that? Well, you could have the interest in just the beta 1, which we have in epidemiology. You don't care about the others, that's confounding. So you want an unconfounded beta 1. You could be interested in prediction. In which case, it's a linear combination for some profile of all of the betas. That's the second one, risk prediction. And the third one is you could be interested in the entire vector at once. They do not have the same implications for sample size and precision. They're very, very different. So I went to great lengths in the thing to talk about that. Here's another one. This is quite harmful. I've seen a lot of these going on now where people by simulation are coming up with rules of thumb. I told you I'd be after two Ontario people today, right? And those are some of them. They're not in the Biostat Society, I think, but these are dangerous things to say. Because the next thing is people are going to write grants thinking they can get away with as few as that. This was all arrived at by simulation. This is regular Y. This is
the key corresponding to the service you wish to reach.
Okay. This makes no sense, right? It makes no sense. But this is the stuff that's getting out there now. And I'm saying, in general, we have to be very careful about simulation studies and using for rules of thumb. If you don't know what you're trying to establish and why and the logic behind and you can't see what's wrong, these are even more dangerous. Here you're going even further out in a limb without knowing what you're talking about. So I'm quite scared of these. So I took this chance to go back and teach what it is in those three different settings, what sample sizes you needed for working out one beta with great precision, for doing linear combinations and so on, and the things change a lot. Now, the second one then is this one here. This happened after I got sick. But so I want to start here. I took it on because it actually refers to reference limits. You know, one of the things I say is that in a lot of what we do, whether the residuals are normal or not, does it really matter? We teach that it does, but in the end we said there's a central limit theorem that says beta hat is normally distributed. Right? So in the end, the central limit theorem gets us out of trouble whether there's non-normal or normal residuals or anything like that. So we're often dealing with the center. So fitting the line is fitting the center. But here I'm going to bring you now to this one where we're interested in individuals out at the extreme. A bit in a way like this one here. Right? That's kind of a center thing, but that is a combination way out, could be way out at the extreme depending on the x. So here's where I'm talking about. And I had luckily had a good bit of experience with this with pediatricians who were trying to set reference limits for various clinical parameters in medicine. C-reactive protein is a measure of inflammation. Right? Reference limits, when you take them and when you do them well, this woman was really amazing, how carefully she was to get healthy people. Reference limits, what's the limits of normal for a certain chemistry? You have to kick out anybody who has a cold. Anybody who hurt their knee yesterday, anybody who has this, you have a clean set. They're supposed to be the null healthy people. So that was key. And she was very good at that. And then when you see what we had to deal with, because we were essentially setting reference limits for normal as well, for this product that was human growth hormone is produced naturally by the body, but you can take extra, and that's the issue, because it can be foreign and local. You have both, and you're trying to figure out where the local end and where do you think there's foreign substance as well. Yeah. So we had that, and you see they're very good here at picking percentiles for tracking children and so on, and we have 50th, 75th, and 95th, and that's about as far as we go in medicine, is 95. We also, in medicine, if something's wrong, we can check you again and repeat the test. But if somebody is way above the limit on doping, you can't test them again tomorrow. They've caught on to you. So it's a destructive kind of thing. You can get them at the time, and maybe actually you only find out the test is way above the limit 2 weeks later. So they're long gone. So it's a very different story. And the other one that you're going to see when we look at the data, when we got the data from the doping agency, we have all comers who took the test, including people who may well be doping. So we have a mixture of dopers and non-dopers, probably, in there. Whereas in the kids' case, we can kick out all the ones we know are not healthy, right? So, anyway, this is the paper, and let's talk a bit about it. But the main thing is it's not about the mean, it's about the extremes. And it wasn't just 95, it was 99.99. 1 in 10,000, I think it was. Yeah. That's how high they let people go before they'll, say, sanction them. Right? So it started out innocently enough with a knock on my door from my next door neighbor one night early in 2013. I knew he had worked for WADA, the doping agency, which is centered down here in Montreal, but he didn't know what I did. And then he came over and said, "Jim, we need your help very badly." I said, "What's going on? Your house on fire, whatever?" No. WADA has lost a case where they challenged the statistics and we lost the case, and now we're afraid the judge has ruled against us and he told us our stuff wasn't done right, and we think we may lose more cases. We have to hurry on and fix it, and there's another court case coming up and so on. And there was an old retired guy. Be careful if you're old and retired. You got to do it right. This guy left no trail. He changed the model in the middle. He went from gamma to log normal and all sorts of things and didn't tell him, and the judge got really furious that the trail was very badly left. So anyway, he wanted me to redo it. And I said, "How'd you find me?" And he said, "Oh, I went on the website, and the web, and looked for a Montreal statistician, and your name came up." He says, "Oh my God, your neighbor, your next door neighbor." He didn't know I was a statistician. Anyway, "We need your help. So I would you help?" Now your neighbor comes over, it's a little tricky, because at this point, after the Can West said, "I'm not doing this again, it just isn't good for my health." But I said, look, "I can understand you're my neighbor," and so on. And he said, "Look, if I can get other colleagues to help me, yes, maybe we'll do it." But I said, "No matter what, we can't do it till the end of the semester until courses are over. Forget it." And the court twist was coming up in the summer. He said, "Time is the essence." I said, "We can't." Anyway, we spent the summer working it. You have the two other guys here. See, I got smart at this point. I said, "I want to get people who can relieve the stress and who know what they're doing." And that was very important to get. This was a high-profile case. I was not going to do it my own. I didn't know any of the stuff about this anyway, so I needed help. I was willing to organize it and so on, but I really needed technical help. And so we spent the summer out, and we delivered our final report in August of that year, the week of GSM. The same week that Don Berry brought people from Estonia, because it was an Estonian skier who had been sanctioned and got off because of Don Berry's help. And they used a very clever trick with the judge as well. In addition to saying the statistics are bad, they had this, you know, it was about extremes. And what they said was, "Imagine I showed you a picture of a dog, but the tail is cut off the dog. The dog has no tail. And now, statistically, you have to put the tail back on the dog. Right? Could you do it? Without having seen the dog's tail, can you put the tail back on the dog?" It's actually very tough to be asked that question. Of course you need a model, and we were out so far that we had to have a model. It was not like the kids' data where at 95, there's still data. And way above at the end, you have a mix of funny things going on. So anyway, we did it. I appeared briefly in the court case, and it involved a German cyclist, and he had been caught once before for testosterone. That was not allowed in the testimony, which I found interesting. So this was a new case on a different thing. We submitted the manuscript in January. The court ruled against him at the end of February, and then WADA began using the limits later the next year. So they're all the details are here already, but just give you a few points. The limit is based on a ratio of a value from the assay that tends to pick up the artificial stuff, and the other assay tends to pick up the stuff from your own body. So then the ratio, if it's high, is a sign that there's outside stuff going on. Right? But to complicate matters, the distribution of this ratio is also a function of the concentration involved. And it's different in men and women, and so on and so on. Anyway, one pediatrician had told me about this LMS method, which I didn't know about. I knew Tim Cole very, very well. But this is a combination of three things. One for fitting the mean function or the center function, one for fitting the variance, and lambda is the one that does the Box-Cox transformation, and it's doing a different Box-Cox transformation at different parts of the X space. So it's really quite a handful, right? So she put me onto this, and this was a big, big help. See, her axis in growth curves, and Cole's one, the axis would have been age. You could see here the thing spreading out. you can see the nonlinear everything, right? And you may need normality shifting from one way tail to the other as you move along. So that's what's going on. So in our case, it was concentration, right? In our one, it was concentration rather than, and we use concentration, the geometric mean of the two of these assays as our measure. But the problem was that out at the extremes, and this is where splines and those give you a lot of trouble, right? So one thing we did, and it only came to be the night before JSM, I remember I had to revise the entire report, is that we decided we would work with the rank of x rather than x. Very nice trick, because then it spreads the x's out all the way uniformly along the x-axis. So now you haven't got that stability issue. So a ranking distribution, or a transformation on x, will spread all the data out across properly and then model in that space, and then come back later. It was actually quite helpful. I don't know if it's kosher or not, but that's what we did. So we used LMS then on that, but with ranked x as our x. And then secondly, we already had the ratios logged, but we already put the logged numbers into the boxcocks again. So we were like doing everything double and triple for safety, because we eventually had to use log normal, we had to stay normal at some point on something. So that was another thing. Then there were two separate kits as well, so that was an extra problem. So I'm going to give you the final fit for the females here. Oh yeah, we have one other ugly thing as well. You see those green ones? These are levels that are so low that they wouldn't even calculate a ratio. It's too dangerous to calculate a ratio when the concentration is low. So automatically when the concentration is low, they let the person off. They don't even calculate a ratio. And women have a lot more growth hormone than men. So there's a lot of low levels in the men. So there's a piece here, the green dots are the ones where they said leave it off. But it's unusual to be truncating your y's. When you truncate on x, you're also truncating y in a non-vertical way. So you're introducing error between the, or correlation between the epsilon and the mu. So Ole was the one who said, we got to get this right or else we'll be attacked again by those naysayers about our models. So we harmonized so that we were cutting cleanly, so we were conditioning vertically. So, and then I told you about the rank, yeah, and these are just the first couple of quartiles, but we're going way up to the top. So there's the fitted one for one of the kits for females, right? So you have the 325 centimeter fiber, but the red line, the solid red line, is 99.9. And the dotted line, the thin dotted line above it, is the confidence interval for that red line. The statisticians and the previous one hadn't even thought about that, that if you're estimating something, you've got to put the margin of error on the estimation again. Now, the statisticians for the guy in Germany wanted a 99.99% confidence interval here again. And I said, you got to stop at some point, guys. We're already letting you off like crazy. These, by the way, are the people who had been caught before. We couldn't take them out because they weren't proved. So we had to leave in all those cases. Here are all four kits. You see in the men, a lot more people way up here. We did take out the cheaters that had admitted cheating. But if they hadn't admitted cheating or weren't sanctioned, they had to stay in. So, of course, they're bringing up the limits for themselves. It's helping them stay in. So, anyway, it was quite the story. So, then to talk just a little bit about... they didn't take out... the other thing is, WADA didn't take our word for it alone. They had commissioned independently, and I didn't know this, a separate report by a French author who independently did the analysis again. They were so scared about this. And then they brought us together in Montreal to write a final report. And the box plots are obviously one of the things as well for the different sports categories, because different sports categories were in all these ones. And when I introduced Dick Pound to open the IBC here in Montreal in 2006, some of you will remember, Peter and some of you were here, he laughed when I told, we had 800 people at IBC here in Montreal in 2006, and Dick Pound opened it. The Australians were all scared of him because he was trying to get all the Australian cyclists kicked out of sport. And he said, he laughed when I told him we were going to test all the speakers, that he was going to test all the speakers at the conference for performance-enhancing drugs. But he was not amused, and I still have the video of it, when I said to the audience that he was the only statistician I know. He's a lawyer and an accountant. He was the only one who could estimate the proportion of ice hockey players in Canada who are on drugs without ever examining any one individual player. And I called it the Dick Pound estimator, and it gives an answer of 30%. And he went white with anger at the time and taught me, this is what's wrong with the tenure. You remember the tenure system? This is what's wrong. Handy and them, that's what's wrong with the tenure system. So, anyhow, it was quite something. But the residuals were a big piece of it. But one, trying to show normality is tricky, even with 10,000 or 5,000. So one of the things we did to show that this is a tough area is, I think this is the raw data. This is before transform, after transform. And this one actually is generated from real normal data. And it's actually hard in some of the cases to tell which is the real, you know, one that came from the bona fide one, from whatever. There's a lot of noise at this point, and it's interesting to always keep yourself honest by looking at what would happen even with REAP when the model was right. So we sent in the analysis. There's the whole thing, the big report with us all done together, and so on and so on. Yeah. So that's number two. And now I want to come to the last piece, and I deliberately put this last because it's what I've spent the last 20 years on, and I think it's the biggest ticket item I've dealt with, is to do with cancer screening. And I had been in the cancer business before, in clinical trials for the first 7 years, very disillusioned, left them, there wasn't much progress year by year, but obviously if you go back to things later, things are very different now. But screening is a place where we spend a lot of money and we're not sure how much benefit we're getting. So I'm going to dedicate this part of the screening thing. And this is also my campaign against non-proportional hazards. Let's call it that. It's my last campaign, right? And, you know, I accepted proportional hazards for the longest time and thought it was the easiest thing, and it was great if it was proportional hazard, but I never thought of why it should be. I think now the default should be it's non-proportional until you can show otherwise. That's not the way it is at the moment. And I see when I read the Cox paper, he had a test of non-proportionality in his paper, but he had 19 subjects. You can't tell non-proportional from proportional in 19 subjects. And I think now, because Cox didn't find it, everyone thinks, oh, proportional hazard is always right by default. So I want to dedicate it first to this three exceptional people. This one was my teacher at Waterloo. He was my first boss. He really set up the clinical trials industry the clinical trials milieu for biostatistics in cancer in particular. And moreover, he has something people didn't know about him. He spent a lifetime contributing to cancer screening as well. That was the first thing he worked on and the last thing he worked on, separately from everything else. So he's one. The second one is this cardiologist. He dragged me into screening in 1995 when the PSA test came out. He was former dean of medicine here doing technology assessment, and he was asked by the Quebec government to look at the evidence for whether the government ministry should be paying for PSA tests in men or not to detect prostate cancer. And the third one then, and we published this, and basically what we said, and I don't think that advice has changed very much, although we had no data at that time on benefit. We had a lot of data on harm. And we said the harm is definitely there. It's big. We don't know about the benefit, but it's probably small, so maybe the government should spend its money on something else. That was the message to the government. It's still true today. And we've had a big surge of it here, and it's been tough, and the benefit is very, very small, and there's a lot of harm. Now, the third one then is this one, a colleague, Ole Mietnen, who produced a very important paper in 2002 looking at mammography for breast cancer that said, when you look at the hazard ratios year by year comparing breast cancer with screening with no breast cancer screening, you cannot expect the hazard ratio to depart down from one immediately. There's going to be a delay before the benefit of early screening, early detection, is going to show up. Right? And so That was a big one because that changed everything for the way we looked at things. McGregor and those had used that in their calculations here in Quebec for advising the Quebec government on breast cancer screening. They started looking only after 4 or 5 years into the trials. That's where the benefit should be if it's there at all, but it won't be there in the first few years. Yeah. So, now to come back to the appropriateness of a hazard ratio, and I ask people, when would you expect proportional hazards? And honestly, it's a fairly small list of situations where you would expect proportional hazards. There's one very good one, where it'll be sustained if in Africa men have adult circumcision to prevent getting HIV. Just think about it. That's a gift that keeps on giving. Get me? You're protected once you're protected, and the protection is 50% in all the trials in Africa. Right? It's permanent. It's not going to go away. Right? So you have an immediate 50% reduction for the rest of your life, unless you get much more risky in the sex. But if otherwise there's the same, that's what it is. It's immediate. It's the same as vaccines. Vaccines have an immediate protective effect. It wanes eventually after decades, but it's there for years. Right? So anything that's like that is going to give you immediate reduction, and the hazard ratio should stay constant or close to that if nothing else happens. But that's not what's going to happen in other things. But here, the other place where it would happen, or we know differently, is if you're taking blood thinners like aspirin or beta blockers, the protection is only for as long as you're taking them. And we know that you stop analyzing when you stop taking. You don't go looking at how much my blood thinners today are going to prevent my stroke 4 years from now if I stopped in the meantime. So that's a case where we know well about the effect of time. So that is, it goes with, when you're on the agent and the drug's on board, the hazard will be down, it turns off as soon as you do. But cancer screening is different than all those again. Right? Cancer screening is very different. It's considerably delayed, and the poster child for it is prostate cancer screening. Why? Because we have a lovely trial from Europe, came out in 2009. We didn't have it in 1985 when McGregor and I were advising the government, but we now do. And these are the results. After 9 years of follow-up, this many deaths, fairly large numbers of deaths, hazard ratio of 0.8, which means a reduction of 20%. So if you look at that, and that's what most people hear, that has stuck in the consciousness, but by chance they published also a Kaplan-Meier or Nelson Allen cumulative hazard type thing, and you notice you can't see any light between these two curves for about 7 years. Right? So that's the most unusual case where there's no benefit for the first 7 years, and then the benefits start coming. Right? So we started looking at this. We didn't think this was right, that they should be calling this a 20% reduction, when basically there's no reduction for 7 years, and then maybe a reduction for 6 or 7 years. I still remember up at the Vic when we presented this to somebody, and there was an older than me man there, who was about 74 or 5 at the time, and he said, should I be getting my PSA test done? And we told him it's 7 more years before the benefit. He said, attack with it. I'm not worried about that. 7 years from now, I'll be somewhere else. Don't worry about it. So, yeah, so we reanalyzed the data, and that's a whole story by itself, and saying, let's look at the hazard ratios year by year, right, to see what was going on. It's hard to see with these curves, but if you break the data down and do it one by one, you will actually see here, I'll give you, here they are. I'm not going to give you hazard ratios. Well, I've given you fitted ones here, but there's nothing going on here at the hazard ratio of 1, and it's only down here it starts changing. So this is like that bathtub shape that Mietman was talking about. The benefit is starting to show up out. But because of the crazy way that they had accrual in this study, it took them forever to get patients in, not men in the subject, into the study, they have very few data here. Just when the signal is getting good, the data are petering out. Right? And they have lots of data here and lots of deaths at the beginning, obviously weighting the reduction to the null end rather than to the 50%. So, So it was very much front-loaded, and I'll explain why. They had very staggered entry. Yeah. So here's the thing in bigger numbers here. But if you look at this, you don't need any model to see that it's 59, 30, so whatever, 40, 25, 40, 24, 21, 8, 11, 3, and then the story stops. Right? But you see where the person time is, 80,000, whatever, men in this study. It's probably the second biggest trial in screening. The biggest one is 200,000 women randomized to ovarian cancer screening or not. This is the second biggest with prostate. Right? So this is a much easier way to do it. And Oli and I have been pushing this, and now we have packages called case-based for actually drawing these kinds of things. This is a much better way to show what's going on, because the gray area here is the person time. So if you like, if you take the integral of that gray area, it's the man years in the study. And then you actually look at the red dots, those are the deaths from prostate cancer in both. Right? So you see very quickly what's going on. There's not a lot here, but there's still too many, and they're dominating. Can you see a reduction or a thinning out in the density here? Yeah. So we're pushing this idea of using density. And Mietten calls it incidence density instead of hazard function, which is a bit more strange to think about. Right? So that's part of our campaign as well, and the students and Oli have written up that. Now, we come to colon cancer, which is actually one of the poster trials of what cancer screening should do and does. It's one of the successes. And here's a 30-year study of colon cancer from Minnesota. This was FOBT, just stool tests. They reported reductions of 32% if you screen every year, and if you screen every second year, and 20, no, the other way around. 22 every second year, and 32 if you do it every year. Okay? But these curves here conceal a lot again. This is my point. Survival curves tend to conceal. Hazard functions tend to reveal. Right? Age-specific things tend to reveal. Accumulation is hard, and it's tough for us to do things on scales that are both going up like that. So I'm not a big believer. Sammy Suisse is always preaching against how little information people can get out of these. I think, Carl, do we have time? Because I want to do a little thing of radiology here. How are we for?
Keep going?
Yeah, okay. This is unusual here because it will become clear in a minute. This was the lottery for Americans going to Vietnam in 1970. It was done the end of 1969, the lottery where the birthdays were picked out of a drum and they were sent to Vietnam in order in which they were called out of the lottery drum. Right? And that's the guy picking out the first ball there, and so on. So you got a number from 1 to 365. If you got number 1, it meant you were called up first, then number 2s were called up second, and so on. If you got 366, that was good. So if it's a fair lottery, you should see uniform distributions between 0 and 360, right? Or 366. So looking at that, what do you think? Does it look random to you? By the way, who knows the story already? The old guys. Be careful. Don't say a word to the young guys, right? We'll see how good their eyesight is. Right? What do you think? What do you think here? So you have plotting the actual day, the year you were born on the x-axis versus your number drawn out on the y-axis. So that should be random. Right? So how good are you at... Do you see anything wrong with this? And now, be warned. I wouldn't be telling the story if it were random. Anybody see anything? In all the years I've given this in statistics classes, only one person has spotted it. What's wrong with this data? And you know what profession he was? He was a radiologist from Australia. And he said to me, "Oh, it's very obvious. There's a defect in that upper right quadrant." He's used to reading x-rays, scintigrams of kidneys and so on. There's a defect, a filling defect in the upper right quadrant. Now that I've pointed you there, do you see the filling defect? Not really. But if you array them out by month, from January to December, are you convinced now that there's something going on? Yeah. What was going on was this. They put the numbers in by month into the drum. They didn't mix them. So January got at the bottom, December got at the top. This guy didn't even mix them, and then his arm is so short he starts picking out from the bottom up to the top. Right? Major, major thing. I have the correspondence between Nixon and Kissinger on this. A major public relations mess. Right? New York Times had it first. I'm going to be writing up because there's another disaster from 1940 where they screwed up as well. There's some really interesting stories, and there's 100 years of lotteries of the U.S. Army, and I'm going to be writing that up for next year. But anyway, here's the one. So clear, right? You have to smooth, and then you can see signal. But it's hard to see signal and noise, and we think we're good at this. But the radiologists are way better. So why did I bring that up? Because I'm now going to take the data from the colon data. We have 30 years of follow-up. Remember, there was a 20% reduction and a 30% reduction in two arms. And is the rest of the water there? Yeah. And I will show you some plots. Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thanks very much. I'll show you some plots and see how good a radiologist you are. Right. So, let me do it. So we can divide the data up into 30 years of data into 30 one-year bins. And I can give you 30 hazard ratios. Right? And there'd be one for blue and one for red, because there's a, you know, every 2 years and every 1 year. So I can give you 30 one-year hazard ratios. I can give you 15 where there's a bin of 2 years wide, all the way up to a 130-year bin. And that's what they did. Their 30-year bin saying it's a 22% reduction or 32, right? So I'm going to give you all the bins and see what you think. So, you see, that's what they did. They had one bin of 30 years, 32% and 22%. Now, what's this? This is 10-year bins, 3 of them. 5-year bins, 6 of them. 3-year bins, 10 3-year bins. Do you see any pattern, whatever? Stick to one color. Do you see any pattern in the timing? But be careful now, because you're making a lot of tests here, right? And in an unguided way. It's hard. Part of the problem here is that the bins are non-overlapping. So a much better way, and something I use a lot now, is moving windows. So you have a moving average where you're moving the window, right? And now let me show you the data again. This time, time lumped, but now the bin is moving. Any good eyesight now? Anybody willing to say there's a signal there somewhere that they can see in a funny shape? I went around Purvis Hall, our building, and asked a lot of people this. And I got one public health guy. Nobody's willing to say they see a pattern here? Luke, no? There's a hole in the middle. Yeah. One guy said, it's a W shape. There's a U-shaped curve, there's a W-shaped curve. He saw a W. Where did he see it? Here. Yeah. If at the right and here too, maybe. There's a W shape. Yeah. Amy knows the story well, right? She's up there. Yeah. So this is the Microsoft smooth. You just say, smooth the data, and that's what Microsoft says. No model, no anything, just I don't know what the programmers put into it from Microsoft. But then you start to see why it is. Can you see why it is? What does S stand for here? This is when they were screening. They lost their funding because they underestimated the sample size. And they didn't do enough, and they didn't know about the delays. So it took them 5 or 6 years to get funding and to start screening again. When they stopped screening, things went back to the effects start wearing off. It's like you stop drinking and then you start drinking again, right? Same thing here. Then when they start again, you see the second phase. So, I mean, there are other things in colon cancer, because colon cancer screening takes out two kinds of things. It takes out precancers that never become cancers. So it reduces the incidence, but it also takes out cancer that's already there. So it has two waves of effect. So it's a very special one. But this is quite clear here that there's also a funding effect here. And so when we redid it, and now I'm mentioning Amy, Lou, because this is, we fitted a model that I'll explain in a minute to you, to the actual data, and we got parameters from the model, and from the parameters of the model, we were then able to, Amy was then able to fill in what would have happened if they had lost their funding, which is the way we should be thinking. They didn't want, we had told them there was a problem, and they didn't care. They were happy with 20%, 30%. I said, it's more, more. So Amy's model was able to fill this in. And now let me explain that a little bit. What is it? So the thing was that people up to then had said screening is a one-time thing. I don't care whether it's 10 rounds or one round, they treat it as a binary, treat it or not. No care about when the deaths occur, when the screening starts, when the screening stops. They were even saying in that one that the effect persists up to 30 years. That's not right. That's what they said, though. The sustained reduction up to 30 years. It's not a sustained reduction. If you look at it right, the reduction is gone by 30 years. So you really have to be paying attention to time here and how many rounds of screening and when they are. So our model is very simple. It says if you didn't screen at all, maybe there's, I don't know, 100 deaths a year. Just keep it simple. So there'd be 100 deaths every year from age 50 to age 85, let's say. Now let's say you start screening and you take one screen, you have one screen at age 50. Where is going to make a hole in the mortality? Well, will it help the people who are going to die, who haven't been diagnosed yet but are going to die next year? No way. They're so far advanced that it's too late to catch them. Will it, so it won't catch, help these people? Will it catch the people who would die of the cancer 30 years from now? No. So in between must be the group where it's just at the right place, where it's detectable and curable. But the trouble is, at the moment, it's a trade-off between curability and detectability. And there must be a sweet spot, Goldilocks type of thing in the middle, not too soon and not too late, right? And that's what we're saying here. So our model says there's got to be something like this for one round of screening, where there's a sweet spot, certain down the line, and that would be your best place, that if you're going to die at 56, the best time to have had the screen would be at age 50, 6 years before, right? And there's obviously a variation on that. But it's like making a hole by an intervention. But now what happens if you have two or three or four or five screens? Well, they're all staggered one after the other. It's like taking a drink an hour. That's my model for it. In the pharmacokinetics, we have this idea of a drink an hour, right? So what happens then? If we take all these, you're now going to have an amalgamation of all the delayed impacts, one after the other, right? And so you'll get this plateau at some point, and then when you stop altogether, that's what's gone. But you see, round number 5 has effects all the way from here to here, and round number 10 from here to here. So we were trying to fit this to the data, and that's what Amy did, in fact, with her data. So the thesis has lung cancer, colon cancer, prostate is in there? No. And then this one again gives all the main ones again. And the colon one is sort of a centerpiece because it's probably the best. Yeah. But lung cancer was in there too. But in the lung cancer screening, they only had 3 rounds of screening. In the colon cancer, they went, you need more rounds to see what's going on, because we're trying to basically disaggregate the whole thing. So I say at the end that if you're going to be in this cancer screening business, it's a long career. You're going to hand it over to somebody at some point. You just cannot expect to get all this going and answers in a few years. And it was funny because I was talking to the European guy, Schroeder, who was doing the prostate study and whatever, and I said, you know, you've started a study in 1992, you've published the first results in 2008, and I'm complaining that there's not enough data out there 8-9 years, right when it gets tantalizingly interesting. And his guy's 73 already, and he wants to retire. And he says, I can't stay any longer. I said, well, you should have gone into another screening business instead, and you could have retired sooner. And the screening that he should have gone into and would have had more effect than the mortality of prostate cancer is screening for aortic aneurysms, abdominal aortic aneurysms, which you can do once with ultrasound. If there's a problem and they look big, it's kind of an expansion of the vein and so on, or the aneurysm, anyway, I know it's vein or artery, but you can repair it, and then basically it's like fixing a bald tire in your car. But the thing with an aneurysm, it's as likely to kill you tomorrow as it is 10 years from now. It doesn't grow that much, it does a little bit, but it's not like cancer that's going to go like this. It's like that's always a threat, and so the benefit is nearly immediate, just like the circumcision. Right? So if you fix it, you can do that. So after 1 year, there's a 50% sustained reduction in mortality just from one screen. So I said to Dr. Schroeder, you should have been here and you could have retired by here. So I think that's it. I had written out the last part though. Yeah, so I said it's all about time, but from a career planning perspective, there's a certain loneliness to it. So be prepared for a very delayed rather than immediate gratification, and be prepared, as I have to at some point, to pass on the work. So just to finish up then, what can I say so far about my life in biostatistics? Only that it's been very good to me, and I hope that through biostatistics I've helped in some way in the public's health and happiness as well. And I highly recommend a career in biostatistics, but please put the bio part first and up front. And so that's it. And now I have to give acknowledgements, and the acknowledgements are here. Yeah, so I had NSERC granting from here to here. I got one CHR grant in my life from 11 to 14, and I've managed to convince CHR to keep the money that I haven't spent each year. It's a trick you might want to know about. They don't take it back if you make a case that there are circumstances and so on and so on. So I had that. And then the last one, I got £100 from this company, from this agency in 1969, to fly from Shannon Airport to Toronto Airport. And I've never paid it back. But I hope, in the big scheme of things, that there's one final report for everything. All right, so that's it. All right. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Jim. I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit about publication in the subject matter clinical journal. Were you encouraging that from the methods perspective with new methods, or were you talking also just about education?
No. I think the ideal model is the one that Norm Breslow used to use. Norm would always try and get two papers out of something. He would have one for the American Journal of Epi, two-stage case-controlled sampling, worked example, so on and so on. Norm was very much, if it's good, put it into Biometrica or Statistics in Medicine and other things as well. No, I'm not downplaying it. I mean, if I had my way again, I'd probably... My problem is I didn't have the confidence at the time to go for the big journals, and I had no mentors. Unfortunately, Waterloo, this is going to come out late and it's kind of sad, kind of sour, but I had a chemist for a PhD advisor who didn't understand the statistics and didn't care about putting it in. And I was young and I didn't understand that publications mattered. So my publications for my PhD are in CMAJ and a few other places on smoking. I mean, they were good for me and I got a lot of respect for data and so on. When I went to Buffalo and I saw Steve Legakos was a colleague, Dave Schoenfeld was a colleague, Marvin Zeller was a colleague, I had a very low self-esteem statistically and I didn't have that sense that I could do stuff. And it was the ROC stuff that finally gave me the confidence. At that point, though, I wasn't in the big leagues yet. And I said, look, I'll just put it wherever Barbara says that it makes sense. Later on, obviously, now I have more courage and do it. But I advise people to go for the mainstream biostat stuff. But why not also put the application paper separately as another one that the other side will see? And then I think you've got the best of both worlds and can speed it up. But I think it isn't getting over enough. I still think that we should be trying to put stuff in the subject matter journals as well, especially if something you worked out for kidney disease or for this or that. So, no, I'm not downplaying one or the other.
One more question?
Yeah.
How do you deal with the, just carrying on that theme, how do you deal with the issue where the subject matter field is actually using methodology inappropriately? in a certain way.
Oh, I go after.
You try and write an expository paper for that subject.
I'm making my career out of it. Yeah.
You submit it to the journal, and they say, no, this should go to a statistical journal because it's too statistical for our journal.
Oh, I think you can. You can still, with good examples, show them what's wrong.
Yeah,
I think so. I've just done one for the Journal of Clinical Epi. It's a really sad story where they came up with a way to analyze matched case control studies with a 1-to-2 ratio. There's a senior statistical Canadian author on there, Canadian-born author on there, with a senior Canadian epidemiologist. And they said they haven't found a method to work out. It wasn't inappropriate, but they were reinventing the wheel. This is what's going on. And I said, Breslow's book has the whole thing worked out. They had Breslow referenced, but never opened him. And worse than that, spelt his name Breslow. And the senior statistical author is a star member and a gold medal winner of this society. So what the hell is going on? I think statistics has gotten too big, and people should only stick to their area and not try to be experts with others. He was outside of his league. But I didn't give the Journal of Clinical Epi the respect and tell him. I've sent it to the European Journal of Epi instead, which is a better journal. And I'm saying, you young guys, don't throw out the old methods, like matching and so on. They're perfectly good still. Because the new thing is, it has to be a model. It can't be matching. That's the bigger issue I'm seeing with statistics today. That's my other campaign.
Okay, if we could just have another round of applause.